This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we will begin today with our Massachusetts congressional delegation. On top of the mind this week, accountability on the administration's rushed exit from Afghanistan and the implications of that, plus the ongoing push and pull on infrastructure as two massive bills hang in the balance. Under just one of those bills, the smaller $1 trillion bipartisan effort, Massachusetts stands to gain some $8 billion in spending for roads, bridges, transit. For more on the wrangling in Washington, we turn to Congressman Bill Keating. He represents the Massachusetts 9th Congressional District, South Shore, South Coast, Cape, and the Islands. He also serves on the House Committee on Foreign Affairs and the House Armed Services Committee. We spoke with him a little earlier this afternoon, and we began with the testimony of Secretary of State Antony Blinken before Congress on Afghanistan and whether Congressman Keating was satisfied with Blinken's explanations for the messy, deadly withdrawal.
Well, I was satisfied with his answers. I thought they were very direct. Clearly, he wasn't satisfied with all aspects himself. So the acknowledgement that that they have to cooperate and the willingness of them to cooperate in our oversight function, I was pleased. When that's the case, that's the most important thing to me. I didn't get any sense that they weren't going to be forthright. They weren't going to share information. Some of it had to be done in a classified setting, as you could understand.
So that's the testimony. Now let's talk about the withdrawal itself. Do you have a grade for the administration on that? And I don't mean to be crass by asking for a grade, but I do want to get a sense for how you evaluate the withdrawal and whether we should have been doing it in such a quick manner.
Well, overall, the grade would have to be incomplete. As long as there are people that we want to get out of there that aren't out of there, the time for grading is premature. The hearing reinforced many of the things we were briefed on. Many of the things that occurred, we were briefed on ahead of time. We were told about the challenges. We were told about some of the difficulties in a classified briefing. We were told about, indeed, not just the likelihood, but the high probability that indeed there would be a terrorist attack during the process and how dangerous that was. All those things were communicated to us. You know, the issues that were brought up in terms of the Bagram airport closing and why that was done, I think presented the Hobson's choices that this administration were left with. The number of military personnel there was too small to support the security around that. I think importantly, people didn't realize that we moved so many of our military out of there prior to what people saw, with no one being harmed. A massive effort. We moved military assets out. We destroyed others. We made others incapacitated. But at the last analysis, having to move quickly was a result of the negotiated agreement. And I'm not saying this to point partisan blame, but frankly, President Trump dealt the cards for this. And in fact, he was at one of his own rallies saying that he left Biden no choice, taking credit for that.
So what are you hearing from members of the military and veterans in your district?
Well, I don't think you can generalize in that respect. There are families I've come to know that lost loved ones in Afghanistan. You know, it's clearly this was an opening up of so much of what their sacrifice and trauma has been. People that won't have, you know, future birthdays or anniversaries or won't have time together. I think all that was opened up. I had a lot of reaction personally, as not to the death they did, but many of the people that served there, we had the opportunity to go and visit in country and to talk to afterwards. So I think there was not one feeling. A lot of the veterans clearly were glad to see an end to this.
Talk about that personal reaction, Congressman. Do you mind? You said you had a reaction personally.
Well, I thought back to some families that lost loved ones and realized that this is once again bringing so much back to them personally. I thought back to some of the people that I was able to visit back home, you know, at Bethesda with terrible wounds. I thought back to one incident when we were going across Afghanistan in a helicopter, a group of us, and we were asked, would we want to participate in a fallen comrade ceremony? There were about, I think, five of us. And we agreed to do that. So they diverted the helicopter and we landed in the midst of a desert. And all you could see is desert land And then in the desert was a casket with a flag on it of a soldier who had been killed in action just hours before. That soldier was on his way back home to Dover, Delaware, and then to his home, which, interestingly enough, was Massachusetts. I don't want to share the name of the person that was killed in action without talking to the family first, so they're not shocked hearing that. But the dignity and the stillness, I just came back right to that moment in my mind. You always go back to that. And I wish I could go back to that and take the next step and tell you how to explain or how I could put into words what that is. But that's what happened to me. And I know it was happening to people that served, people that had wounds, people who suffered a loss of a family member. And I think more than anything else, all those thoughts kept flooding back.
I appreciate you sharing that with me. I want to talk now for a minute about resettlement here. We're learning now about the plans for Afghan refugee resettlement in the U.S. Yesterday, the Biden administration started to notify governors around the nation about how many refugees they can expect in their states from an initial group of 37,000. From that group, Massachusetts is expected to house about 900. Do you have any more information about efforts to resettle Afghans here in Massachusetts?
Well, one of the most important things came out at these hearings, and that's that people should understand the screening process that occurred for these people. Because I know that there are some that are saying it's already started for political reasons, I think, largely, that are saying these people are a great threat. They're going to come in. They'll present a threat to our communities. These people are screened, some of them going through the very prolonged SIV, which is Special Immigration Visa, you know, several years of screening, and others that are in the process of that screening. I want people to know the screening process has been involved.
Thank you for that. How do you want the people of the Commonwealth to assist in this effort?
Well, I think people already are. I think there's groups, local groups, community groups, nonprofits that are all going to work. These are people, a large number of them, that risk their lives to help support our efforts and a pro democracies. They put their lives in jeopardy to help us, not because we're the U.S., but because they have such strong feelings on, and I'm sure great, profound disappointments about what happened in their country in terms of moving their country forward. I remember this. There was a person that assisted soldiers. And when I was there, the Marines took me to a village, and I was well protected by them, but it took me to a village to meet someone, because they wanted me as a congressman to thank this individual who's giving them information about where IEDs, explosives, were planted, saving lives. And so I did. And I thanked the person as they requested. But I had one question for that man. I said, you're risking your lives. And he really was. Why are you doing this? And he turned around and moved a young boy about 8 years old in front of him. And he said, this is why. This is my son. He's 8 years old. I want him to have an education. I want him to have a chance in life. I don't want him to have to live the life we're doing now without opportunity.
Do you know if that man and his son made it out?
I don't. And I must tell you, the odds were not great, because this was several years ago.
I do want to move on to another issue that has strong local implications before we're done, Congressman, and that is infrastructure, which sort of hits like a thud after the conversation we were just having, but it is still really important. There are two bills on the table, smaller, more focused bill, larger $3.5 trillion reconciliation or social infrastructure bill, and we understand the coalition's fragile, and I want to know, do you think one or both are ultimately going to make it to the president's desk?
I think both will. I don't know what form the reconciliation bill will be in. But for the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, we're going to take it up before the 27th. That was already agreed upon by the speaker in terms of when it would be taken up. We're not going to have a great opportunity, the House, to do anything with that. It was put together with such a fragile grouping of senators, Republican senators, joining with the Democratic senators. I don't think that can be changed, because we run the risk, if we change that and send it back to the Senate, of that falling apart. I do believe we'll be able to cobble enough support on the Democratic side for a reconciliation package. This, as you mentioned, the margin is very thin, but I do think people will recognize this. Even if you don't get everything you want in that, people should realize this. They're hearing $3.5 trillion. How are we going to pay for it? That's over a 10-year period, number one. Number two, it's paid for. What we did that the Republicans didn't do in 2017 with their tax cut, we're showing how the revenues will be replaced to make up for that. And that's going to create some controversy. That might be something that has to be changed in the reconciliation bill, too. So our job is to move forward, and I think we will, with the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, if you want to call it the bipartisan bill, and then move ahead with reconciliation.
So I want to follow up on something that you said about it's paid for. People might think $3.5 trillion is a lot of money. Let's stay on that for just a couple of quick questions. In the smaller package, the $1.5 trillion, Senator Markey's office has told us about $8 billion for Massachusetts. Then we're talking about the big one as well. Massachusetts has spent less than $200 million of the $5 billion in pandemic relief we've already received. We're hearing stories federally about almost 90% of rental assistance money yet to be distributed. So first, can we get the money out, money of this magnitude? I recognize it's over 10 years, but I think it's still a fair question.
Well, I think that there will be little trouble getting infrastructure-related money out. And what's there in reconciliation will get out. Some of the hang-ups on money not spent, if you look at the whole country, it takes two to tango. So the federal government has the money. It's there. Some states aren't acting because they, for policy reasons or the inability to deal with issues, they aren't acting. The infrastructure money, they will act on. The money that will be there in reconciliation, they will act on. We're already benefiting from a tax cut to families with children that's nothing short of historic. And that money is now coming to families monthly. So it's being spent as they need it for basic needs. But pre-K money, which to me is the best money we can spend value-wise, that money will save us so much money and improve the lives of the families, but also improve our economy going forward. I represent the oldest district outside of Florida, and a lot of the money for home care and seniors to keep them in their homes when the alternative is expensive nursing home and Medicaid costs.
So you're expressing optimism there that the money will get out. I think I'm also mindful, just because of the magnitudes that we're talking about, Congressman, of the big dig, $22 billion, delays, safety issues, overspending. So I do want to ask, as the legislation comes together, will it include sort of accountability and oversight mechanisms that are important, I think, to voters?
Yeah, you mentioned the big dig. I was in the state Senate at the time and was pushing very hard to keep our state oversight in place. And part of that process, to get the money out quicker, we sold away, we being the state, some of our oversight over the project just to get it out. Some of this money, a large portion, is going to go from the federal government to state government to utilize itself. So that state oversight will be in place as well as federal oversight. So you'll have dual layers of oversight. I think that we're capable of that. Anything of that magnitude, even small things, demands that kind of oversight. So it'll be there, but it'll be there, much of it, on dual levels.
All right. That is Congressman Bill Keating. He represents the Massachusetts 9th Congressional District, the South Shore, South Coast, Cape Cod, and the Islands. And he serves on the House Committee on Foreign Affairs and the House Armed Services Committee. Congressman, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Tiziana, thank you very much.
As of today, members of the Massachusetts National Guard are driving school buses in Lawrence and Lynn. This after Governor Charlie Baker activated the Guard Monday to help with shortages in Chelsea, Lawrence, Lowell, and Lynn. Since then, Worcester, Woburn, Quincy, and Revere have also signed up. About 120 Guard members have trained and received their licenses, mostly to drive the special 7D school bus transport, well, they're really vans, vehicles that take students with a variety of special needs to school. So how did we get here? We welcome Superintendent Almi Abeda of Chelsea Public Schools and Drew Damian, Director of Transportation and Facility Rental at Palmer Public Schools. He's also the president of the Massachusetts Association of Pupil Transportation. Superintendent Abeda, welcome back.
Thank you. It's always nice to be here.
It's good to have you. And Drew, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
So, Superintendent Abeda, I'm going to start with you. Take us to the moment when you heard that the governor was going to bring up the National Guard to drive school buses. What did you think, and how quickly did you sign on?
Well, I received a call actually just, it was last week. So everything has been moving very fast. And so when I received the call, hey, would you be interested in this, and I had no idea what my other colleagues, superintendent colleagues, were doing. But when I heard it, I'm receiving phone calls over here at central office. Our buses are running late. Parents are upset because whatever reason. And I was like, absolutely, sign me up. So I was excited just to get any help that I could get. So we're just very grateful for the commissioner and our governor for thinking out of the box and being creative and finding a solution to help us.
So, Drew, there's like two questions I want to ask you at once. I think sure. I'll ask because of what the superintendent just said, thinking outside of the box. I admit, when I first heard it, I thought, wow, that cannot be typical to have National Guards people driving school buses. Am I wrong, or is this pretty out of the box?
This is pretty outside the box. Actually, we, you know, around the state, when this first was announced, a lot of eyebrows did go up in the air. But one of the things that I like to say as I represent the districts in MAPT is we need to think outside the box, and we need to think with the glass half full. The National Guard has a reputation for working with civilians very successfully across a broad range of areas and professional jobs. And so we thought to ourselves, what a great idea to have something like this come along and present an opportunity to make it work. And I'd also like to say, you know, thank you to the governor and the commissioner, but also to the Registry of Motor Vehicles, who stepped up quite quickly to make it possible to get these folks the basic training that they would need to get behind the wheel and work with these children that, as you mentioned earlier, are you know, are most critical in need for whatever reason, whether they be a special education student on the educational side or whether they are homeless or unable to access school for some other reason and fall into a catchment where we transport these students sometimes great distances back and forth between their schools and their current placements.
So, Superintendent Abeda, and Drew, I'm going to ask you this same question in a minute. From your perspective, how did we get here?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I do believe a lot of it has to do with COVID. There's certainly, I'm assuming there's certainly some fear out there. You're on a bus, it's small, enclosed. It could be, you know, I know the windows have to be open. But if you're immunocompromised or you have a family member that might be, and maybe you're closer to retirement, and you might just say, you know what, it's time for me to retire. Maybe I don't want to, I'm not up for this right now. And so I do think that we have to think about that. And so COVID has brought a lot of challenges in many areas, not just transportation. And so this is just one little sliver that we're addressing, but there were other complications, as you know, with getting school started, and there's just so much that's been impacted as a result of COVID.
I appreciate that. Drew, my understanding is COVID is a lot, but it's not the only thing. Some of this was coming beforehand as well.
Absolutely. So we have had school bus driver shortages from the Atlantic to the Pacific intermittently and ongoing at different rates for a long time. As the superintendent mentioned, that it's very important to remember, I think COVID was the last ingredient in what was brewing to be a perfect storm for a long time. And she's very astute in mentioning that, you know, a lot of these folks were very close to retirement. School bus driving is inherently a part-time job. So a lot of people are not doing this as a career move. They're doing it to I'm not saying there aren't those that do, but, you know, people do this to augment income, to do something in retirement, to, you know, it's a great stay-at-home mom job. You're driving when the kids are out. You're home with them when they're home. But what happened was, across the board, all of these things started to catch up. And when COVID came, and now you have parents that are worried about children, you have elderly folks that are worried about themselves, younger people who are worried about the elderly folks. It was a part-time status job. The responsibilities are unbelievable. I'm not saying the rewards aren't great, but it all came together, I think. And this caused what I think right now is a cataclysmic shortage of people to transport our students back and forth to school. There are across the country stories of school districts that have to put off start times and all sorts of things. So, yeah, it's here.
So, Superintendent, now let's talk about the kids a little bit. Most of the National Guard members will be driving 7D. They're sort of transport vehicles, mm-hmm. you know, Drew pointed out at the top.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
These are special needs kids. Talk about what safety training the National Guard drivers will receive around care and attention to the young people, how safe you feel for parents, what messages you're delivering to families, et cetera.
Yeah, the National Guard is receiving the exact same training that any school bus or school driver would receive. And so whatever is the protocol that, for instance, we use NRT transportation, and so whatever NRT is training them on the same protocols that our regular bus drivers would receive, I feel very safe and comfortable. And I don't have any reservations.
And what are you hearing from families?
What we're hearing from families is that they're, you know, obviously relieved that kids will get picked up on time and be taken to their schools. And some of the schools for us with the door-to-door transportation, they're outside of Chelsea. And so this is actually a huge relief for many of our families that transportation will be running on time and that their students will get there to schools on time.
So, Drew, I'm kind of trying to figure out how to feel about this. On the one hand, I'm wondering, should I feel particularly heartbroken because the shortage is for drivers of buses for kids who have special needs? Or should I feel particularly encouraged that the top priority was to provide drivers for buses that support kids who have special needs? Do you understand my question?
Absolutely. I'm as I said before, looking at the glass as half full. I think that the opportunity that has been placed before us now is an opportunity for us to resume our trip to normalcy. We are now going to be able to say to families, as the superintendent said, who are concerned about getting their children to school and getting their children to school on time, we can now say we are providing a service. And I truly believe, knowing the Registry of Motor Vehicles staff myself and how they do their training, knowing how companies in this Commonwealth, including NRT, do their training, that we are in good hands. I think what's going to come of this is, besides the fact that we are going to be able to get some kids to school that would otherwise have to suffer with either no transportation or late or inefficient transportation, I think what's going to happen is we're going to create new relationships, and we are going to create a newfound importance in doing the job of getting kids to and from school every day. I think people now will understand that school day is, in fact, from the time the child boards the bus until the time the child gets home. It's all part of the successful school day.
We are talking to Drew Damian, who is president of the Massachusetts Association of Pupil Transportation, and Superintendent Almi Abeda of the Chelsea Public Schools. So, Superintendent Abeda, now, when will there be regular drivers, for lack of a better phrase, back in those buses? Is there an end game here or an end point here?
There is. We have signed an agreement, and basically what we're saying is it's until December. And so hopefully that gives us enough time, our NRT, enough time to recruit drivers, and hopefully this will be just the gap, you know, the amount of time that we need. I imagine that if not, then we can reassess.
And Drew, how are the everyday drivers, the people who've been driving all along, handling this, reacting to it? Do they take on extra responsibilities? How are they feeling about it? What are you hearing?
So, you know, drivers across the state are, like everyone, a little bit surprised at the action. However, again, they applaud moving children safely and efficiently to school. So they're looking for this to be a help. And I know, to feed off of what the superintendent just mentioned, that across the state we're going to be seeing some pretty big outlays of time and funding to recruit drivers going forward.
And what's the long game here, Drew? How do we get ourselves out of this situation permanently?
Well, I think that we're going to have to be very creative. And one of the things that, we have to do is, as I said, you know, recruit people into the programs, get them in, and it may take some pretty Herculean efforts. We may have to look at benefit packages and pay packages, especially as we look at the overall effect of people who are working and who are not working during the COVID pandemic. We have to look at things totally differently than we ever did before. But I think we're up to it. I think Massachusetts is resilient. We're strong. And I think we'll be one of the states to emerge first, as we always have in school bus transportation. We have one of the best programs in the country.
And Superintendent Abeda, who's the kid, the family, that you're picturing in the back of your head, that you thought about when you found out, thank goodness we're going to have some help here?
Well, I thought of our families and most of our students who have been in school, haven't been in school. A lot of our students with special needs opted to stay home for the entire year during last year. So I was thinking our schools are open. We have to get students to school. It's important, and it's an emergency. So we worked so hard to bring our students back with COVID mitigation strategies. We finally are in school, and I want every student to be in school, and I want every student to get picked up on time delivered to school on time. And I think that's so important, and that bus ride is important. It's important for our families. It's important for our students. And so some of the superintendents that I've talked to, like my superintendent colleague in Lowell, I texted him. I said, I guess we're thinking out of the box too. And he's like, at all costs. And that's how we feel about it, at all costs. And we do whatever we can to make sure that our students receive the services that they need.
All right. That is Superintendent Almi Abeda of Chelsea Public Schools. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Drew Damian, Director of Transportation and Facility Rental at Palmer Public Schools and President of the Massachusetts Association of Pupil Transportation. Drew, thanks to you, too.
Thanks so much.
It just got easier and more affordable for some trans and non-binary residents to get gender-affirming health care in Massachusetts. That's thanks to changes by MassHealth. Effective September 1st, they issued updates to what's considered medically necessary in gender-affirming healthcare, and that means they have expanded what MassHealth will cover. Here to talk more about these changes in coverage and what they could mean for our trans and non-binary communities is Dallas Dukar. She's a nurse practitioner and CEO of the organization Trans Health Northampton, which provides physical and mental health services to trans, non-binary, and gender-diverse children and adults. Dallas, thanks for joining us. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon, Tiziana. Happy to be here.
So, Dallas, these changes in coverage include, I'm just going to give some examples, breast reduction surgery, genital surgery, speech-language therapy. How important are these changes, the ones that went into effect beginning of September, for trans and non-binary residents?
Well, these changes are just really, really important. And I want to have a big thanks here to the Trans Health Work Group at MassHealth. MassHealth uses these guidelines, as you said, to determine what care is deemed medically necessary and paid for. And these gender-affirming services really are life-saving medicine, right? They improve mental health, and they also save lives. So by being able to cover many of these areas and also increase reimbursement, we're able to really expand care to the people who need it most and really ensure that trans folks in general and gender diverse folks and non-binary folks are just able to get this life-saving care, and they don't have to deal with the financial hurdles that often have huge mental health impacts on individuals.
So Dallas, so you've just put out the importance of it. So the next thing I want to understand is these changes, are they incremental changes, the next phase in a state that's very forward-thinking, or is this a tectonic shift in coverage for the Commonwealth?
Well, these have been really incremental changes since 2014. So in 2014, we really started to see a prohibition of discrimination against gender identity or gender dysphoria. And then by 2019, we started to see revised guidelines as well. But this is really a tectonic shift for our nation, right? So this is, I've been assured by folks at MassHealth specifically that these are some of the biggest, most expansive changes, most progressive changes that we have seen across the country. And really, they're unparalleled compared to other private payers or government payers too. You know, many, many other payers out there still do not have uniform clinical policies just to make coverage decisions.
Dallas, I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I want to pick up on this point you just made. You said it was a tectonic shift nationally. Will this move the needle elsewhere? Will other states be watching this? Will it push other states to change state healthcare policy as well?
Other states should be watching this. And, you know, my hope is that other states are able to see that, you know, from the data, from the coverage that we're able to provide and the expansion of access, that we're actually able to, in Massachusetts, improve healthcare overall by caring for some of our most marginalized individuals. And when we're able to do that, we'll be able to see just healthier folks that are also utilizing less areas of a healthcare system in general and able to better take care of themselves. So the hope here really is that we'll be able to see the statistics bear this out. And we do see that whenever trans folks have access to healthcare, specifically gender affirming care, we see suicide attempts go way, way down to the national average. We see people that are better able to not engage in different substances, take better care of their body. It just makes sense. When you're able to feel at home in your body, you're able to be more healthy. And that means less utilization overall of insurance.
So I understand this term medically necessary is pretty important, both because it essentially means what's going to get covered, but also because it has a history of being a loaded term, given attitudes for our trans and non-binary communities. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, it is a loaded term. So, you know, throughout the history of healthcare, really, and especially trans healthcare, it's really been cisgender individuals at the table deciding who receives care and who doesn't receive care. And those individuals would decide what's necessary or not and what hoops you have to jump through or not. And really what MassHealth has done here is say, you actually need to jump through less hoops to actually be able to get the care that you need. And really the movement, especially in gender-affirming healthcare, is to move towards away from what's called gatekeeping and move towards really being able to provide patient-centered care, to listen to the patient. We're not assessing patients to see if they're trans, right? We are seeing someone for who they are and helping them to get to the place that they want to be. And that means really putting the power in the hands of a vocal and active and informed patient population and allowing that patient population to very clearly say, this is what's medically necessary because I need it and I decide it, not you.
Dallas, I want to ask this question thoughtfully. Some of these changes apply to those younger than 18. I know there's a good deal of controversy around gender-affirming healthcare for those under 18, both around the role of parents and legal guardians in authorizing care and in perceptions of whether young people are capable of making long-term decisions about their bodies and health. What do you say to those who will be concerned over this expansion of services to people under the age of 18?
Well, this expansion of services still requires assent and consent, right? So consent of the adults and assent of the child. This is a very thoughtful process. Whenever anyone engages in any type of gender-affirming care, we're not doing anything overnight. We're having intentional conversations with the family, with the kids. At Trans Health Northampton, we serve families of trans folks and trans folks because we want to keep families together, right? We want to be able to have those intentional conversations. And so if anything, this really gives more opportunity for parents to better understand their children. At the same time, we know that these interventions are protective. They help people's mental health when necessary and when there are appropriate clinicians that are evaluating this, which there will be appropriate clinicians. Nothing is changing about the type of care delivered. It's just the reimbursement for younger ages, and that's because we know that this is medically necessary. I'll just say that I have seen so many, you know, adolescents that come in and they have to live with parts of their body on their chest that they just don't feel right, they feel alien to them, and they have to really make it through some really tough times in life. So what MassHealth has done here has said, we're actually going to be able to start that conversation earlier, and we're going to be able to really help some of our most vulnerable kids here.
All right, that is Dallas Dukar. She is a nurse practitioner and CEO of the organization TransHealth Northampton. Dallas, thanks for your time today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Finally today, we want to take some time to acknowledge the passing of George Wein. Originally a pianist, Wein became one of America's most storied and influential live music impresarios. He co-founded the Newport Jazz and Folk Festivals. Wein passed away on Monday at the age of 95, and today we want to revisit with you a conversation that Wein had with WBUR's Anthony Brooks back in 2015, marking the 60th anniversary of Miles Davis's iconic performance at the Newport Jazz Festival. It was in 1955.
60 years ago, Miles Davis took the stage at Newport for the first time and performed Thelonious Monk's Round Midnight. It was 1955, early days for the Jazz Festival. George Wein, who was then and remains today at the age of 89, the driving force behind the festival, recalls that memorable performance.
The sound system was terrible that year. Remember, this is the second year of the festival, and we hadn't really developed our technical abilities yet. And Miles put the bell of his horn right in the microphone and overcame the bad sound that some of the bands had to put up with.
This solo stole the show, and it earned Miles Davis a deal with Columbia Records. But as George Wein recalls, this performance would never have taken place if not for a chance encounter with Miles Davis earlier that year.
I was in a club in New York, walking out of the club, Miles is there. And he says, George, you're going to have a jazz festival this year? I says, yes. He said, well, you can't have a festival without me, Miles says. And Miles used to like to repeat statements all the time, you can't have a festival without me. So I called his agent. I brought him up to Newport. He wasn't even advertised. He didn't have a band. Thelonious Monk didn't have a band. Jerry Mulligan didn't have a band. And Connie Kay and Percy Heath were with the Modern Jazz Quartet. So I put this group together, and they just jammed. And they played Round Midnight, and it destroyed the audience.
This version of Round Midnight is part of a new collection of Miles Davis's performances at the festival called Miles Davis at Newport, 1955 to 1975, the Bootleg Series Volume 4. It includes 4 hours of previously unreleased recordings.
Miles, in his book, writes that he used a mute in that solo. And as you can hear now, it was with an open horn. And for some reason or other, Miles remembered that he had a mute. The sound is beautiful now.
George Wein, I'd love it if you could tell the story. So Miles Davis comes off the stage after that performance. A lot of people are paying attention to him now. And he has something to say about the way Thelonious Monk played that, right?
Well, Miles comes up to me and says, tell Thelonious he plays the wrong changes in Round Midnight. I says, Miles, he wrote the song. What are you going to do? I mean, that's exactly the way the world was in that time in jazz. People developed their own sense of improvisation and what they felt comfortable with.
Now, did you know, George Wein, at that moment that you were seeing a historic performance that's been remembered for so long?
I think I did, because what it meant was, for the first time, one of the great trumpet players that emerged out of the bebop era wasn't playing bebop. All the trumpet players were more or less in the Dizzy Gillespie mold. And Miles was the first one to break that mold. And we played the melody on Round Midnight. He just gave it the most beautiful interpretation, very traditional interpretation, even though it was very modern in its actual performance.
Well, I want to ask you about some of the great moments in this collection. Miles Davis came back to Newport in 1958. By then, he's a much bigger star. He's a best-selling artist. He was performing with a sextet that included John Coltrane. So let's listen to his number, Alu Cha. What struck you then about how he had changed, how he was developing as an artist?
Miles was like a chameleon. He absorbed what was happening around him. And he knew that everybody was talking about Cannonball, and there was beginning to be talk about Coltrane. And, of course, Coltrane eventually took over the whole music scene. But at that time, it was all experimenting. And Miles was listening to Coltrane. Miles said to Coltrane, Why do you play so long? Why do you play so many choruses? He says, I don't know. I just seem to keep playing. And Miles says, why don't you try taking the horn out of your mouth? So all of these things. And, of course, Cannonball was a swinger in the Byrd tradition. And it was a great band. It was a fantastic band, you know.
Well, there's great live energy in these recordings, isn't there? I mean, listening back, how do these live recordings give a different appreciation of these guys?
Musicians respond to an audience. And if they went into a hall that night and the people were waiting for them, and the minute they started to play, they could feel the energy in the audience, they responded with the music. And that's exactly what happened with most of these tapes.
So, George Wein, 1969 was a big year for the festival. Tell me about that.
I had all the rock groups on that festival because jazz was at a very low ebb, and I figured that I had to do something to keep the festival au courant, so to speak. Miles stayed around the whole festival when he normally would just come, play, and leave as fast as he could. He stayed around right at my shoulder for two nights, and he saw the response of the audience. And that's when he decided, when he started to play again, to go into a more electronic scene, which he did in the last few years of his life. That's all he played.
Well, speaking of that, so here's a recording of Davis playing Bitches Brew in 1971 at the Newport Jazz Festival in Europe. So let's listen to a bit of this. Bitches Brew was a big moment for jazz. As you mentioned, it was already happening before, but Miles is beginning to fuse jazz with non-jazz elements, and a lot of folks sort of accused him of selling out. What was your take?
I loved the early Miles because the purity of his trumpet was so beautiful. I mean, there was nothing more beautiful in jazz at that time. But the people liked what he was doing, and he enjoyed doing what he was doing. It made it easier on him because he could lean on the rhythm and lean on the sounds of the orchestra, where before he had to carry everything else by himself, just with his horn. And you can hear the difference. So to say sold out is a strange thing. He always wanted to change with the times. And he was just paying attention to that. ¶¶
What's it like for you to hear these recordings again all these years later?
Well, my life is two things. A life of memories, which I try not to get too involved with, but everybody's asking me about my memories. But really, I'm concerned with the future. I'm 90 years old. I'll be 90 in October. But I spend my time wondering about what's going to happen with jazz. There's thousands and thousands of young people playing jazz that come out of schools having studied jazz. So far, we're still leaning on the history of the music. At the same time, you have some people that have evolved into commercial acceptance, like John Batiste. John Batiste, a fantastic musician, and his music communicates.
I went down to St. James Infirmary, and I saw my baby lying there.
Whether he's the one that's the future of jazz, that's another story, but he will be around and a popular figure in jazz for years to come. But I hope I live long enough to see some of the things I dream of.
What has kept you so attached to this music for so long?
I guess I got bit by it when I was about 14 years old, and this bite has lasted. I could have been a major rock promoter and made a lot more money than I've made, but I found out that I'm happy when I was creating my festivals and musicians cooperated with me and we created history, like Miles, like Duke Wynton playing with Tony Bennett just a few years ago and also working with Dave Brubeck on one of his last concerts. There's hundreds of these memorable moments over the years at different festivals. And I enjoy that. I didn't want to just service the groups. I wanted to be involved in producing an event and not just put on a star because they sold a lot of tickets. I could have done that. I've done that when I had to do it. But my love is creating as much as it's possible within the structure of what a festival gives us.
That was WBUR's Anthony Brooks talking with George Wien, co-founder of the Newport Jazz and Folk Festivals, back in 2015. Wien passed away on Monday at the age of 95. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.